Hi, Isabella.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. I spoke to Maggie Appleton, with whom I had a conversation recently on this podcast, and I kind of want to fill you in and talk to you about some of that.
Yes, I would love to hear.
And I would like to also say that this is a continuation of a series of conversations that we've been having. So if people are interested in what we're talking about, there are past episodes that you can look through. Yeah, so we were talking about machine learning, you know, this ChatGPT and the kind of thing that seemingly everyone in our world is talking about, although I'm not sure that everyone in the world is talking about it. I kind of feel like it might just be our world.
I'm actually surprised by the fact that this is the one topic that's actually escaped my weird esoteric bubbles and has gone into my friend group, my academic group. My kids are also talking about it. So I think, yeah, it's relevant to a lot of people.
Bigger. Yeah, I think everyone's having this problem, which is like, you put in the question, you get out the answer. What happens in the middle? And no one really knows the answer to that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and in a certain sense, there isn't an answer in any kind of straightforward way. And this relates to what I was really interested in, because it relates to issues about the corpus, right? Which is only things that are made explicit. And one of the questions I think going around is like, can we just train it on a bunch of super important works in, say, philosophy, and then try and get some meta output that, you know, looks at Kant and Nietzsche and Wittgenstein and Schopenhauer and all the other Germans, or even non-Germans, or whatever it is, like, you know, you decide the corpus and then get some kind of like wisdom out of this. Mm-hmm. And she was skeptical for reasons that were, I think, more intuitive than anything. Whereas I'm skeptical, like my skepticism is kind of coming together, I think. And it actually relates to one of these topics, which is Schopenhauer's view of how language relates to perception, basically.
So, oh, excellent. Because that is one of the 14 next topics I wanted to go and dive into. So please tell me more.
Do you want to start with Schopenhauer or do you want to start with the language models?
I think just the language models would be great.
Yeah. So with language models, there's a baked-in assumption that everything that's important is in the text, and therefore it's explicit, right? It's explicitly said in the text. That's what a text is, right? It's basically you chose the words, you put them in an order, here's the text. Now, one of the problems is that any text comes out of a context, right? It comes from a culture. And in some sense, it's responding to that culture. So these are not timeless pieces of truth. You know, they may seem timeless because they've been selected for a kind of timelessness, and there may be emergent kind of timeless features to them. And yet they are responding very much to their day and age, right?
Yes.
And they're responding to it in a way that does not make those things explicit, right? Like you and I use words transparently, right? And if I say philosophy, then I assume that your definition of philosophy like maps cleanly enough onto mine that I can just say that. Whereas, you know, we had this conversation about history versus experimental sciences a few weeks ago with Sam Biagetti, and he used these terms, which are super relevant to what we're talking about, nomothetic and ideographic.
Right.
But those words didn't actually mean anything to him, right?
Yes.
And so there's like this kind of issue, right? Which is, it's almost like the point at which you start writing is where you start to disagree. Or that's maybe putting it too strongly. You know?
Yes.
Where the conversation,
the point at which you want to connect with somebody. So there is an assumption that there's a disconnect and you're trying to communicate something. So there is a disagreement in some sense, right? Yeah.
Like if I'm going to try and give you a long talk about something, it's going to have all these implicit assumptions of things that we already know about. You know, like we're referring to ChatGPT and we both know what that is. If someone's listening and they don't know what that is, that's going to be an issue, right? Mm-hmm. So then we could start the conversation at a different point if it's intended for a different audience. But this was kind of like the thing that I was pointing to, which is that a corpus always starts, and corpus just means like a bunch of text. Mm-hmm. I've realized that although this is used a lot in machine learning, it's not a normally used word. And no. Other people are like, why do you keep saying corpus? What does that mean? And I'm like, right. It's just like a bunch of text as far as I understand it. And so let's just say the text, like a written philosophical text, is going to start at the point of divergence in some sense, mm-hmm. right? Maybe not right at it, but around it. And mm-hmm. so maybe just before it, maybe you'll say, well, we all know this thing, but I'm going to challenge that. But you can see that there's already a bias in the text because maybe I spend like 5-10% of the text setting up the areas that we agree about or the definitions or something like that. But then like 90 or 95% of the text is just going to be new stuff, right? Yeah. It's going to be like diverging from what we understand to be the existing consensus. And I think that's particularly acute in philosophy.
But, yes.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, even the things that you set up as, okay, can we just agree that this is ChatGPT and we're only going to talk about this part of ChatGPT and not about the graphics, AI, and so on. Even that is making an agreed upon, and we have the idea or the illusion that we're now setting the context. In fact, the context is what you often talked about, the obviousnesses, right? Althusser's obviousnesses. It's all the things that we're not explicitly saying. These are our assumptions, but they're so baked in that we don't even have to highlight them as such. And I think what you were saying is that when you then have a corpus that is about the explicit text and whatever it is, it loses all of that implicit and actually the essential part from which you start, right?
Yes, exactly. And so the point is that in a certain sense, like if someone points out something implicit, something has gone wrong or something is weird about this text, right? Mm-hmm. And so like there's all kinds of unspoken rules that we just don't speak about because they're unspoken and they're better left unspoken, right? And so in a certain sense, all text is skewed maybe towards novelty or something like that, or towards divergence, because it's rare to make explicit things that are just unproblematically implicit, right?
Yeah, I get it.
So that was one point. The other point is just this question of concepts themselves, you know, the things that we articulate through explicitly choosing words and arranging them in a certain order, just writing and reading. One question that we were discussing was whether in a language model, you're going from language to language. So in other words, you're going from a series of abstractions, because all language is abstract, to another series of abstractions, right? Mm-hmm. Now, one of the questions she asked was, why does it matter if a language model generated it? And I'm saying, well, if it doesn't matter, that kind of assumes that the point of a conceptual abstraction is just to produce more abstractions, right? Whereas maybe the point of reading someone else's abstraction relates more to experience. And basically, you know, the normal reason you would read a book is not to have a conceptual understanding, but to learn to see the world a different way, which affects perception, mm-hmm. and use that perception to act differently in the world. And so it may be that the kind of content of philosophy is not, after all, conceptual. In other words, that it may be more perceptual and more experiential than conceptual. And so if you think you can just spin up new philosophies from existing philosophies, that kind of misunderstands what philosophy is.
Can we pause there?
Yeah, go on.
Because this is not a small thing that you just said for the last 3 minutes. There are a bunch of really important points that I think it would be really useful, I think, to expound upon. So one of them is this idea that what philosophy is and the extent to which it's linked to text, right? And what we should get out of text is this experience, right? As we read it, we are invited to see a different point of view. And yet, I would argue that most texts do a terrible job of that. In fact, it is not an invitation to empathic connection and a worldview that might change your mind. Most of the things we read, we put it in the basket that we already have about our worldview and we move on. And so one of the things I think that's really important is to imagine what kinds of texts might be different. So, for example, if you, in that corpus of Germanic philosophy, added Tolstoy and Virginia Woolf and so on, would there be something different that came out of it? Because good texts that understand that language isn't about only conceptualizing does give us an experience, right? And I thought that's what you were pointing to, but don't you think that most texts don't give us that experience?
It's a good question, and one that I kind of hadn't considered, because I think because we were mainly talking about philosophy, and I was saying that I think the point of philosophy is to change your mind and to change the way you see the world. Whether that's the case of general text, yeah, it's probably not the case, I guess. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there, you know, you could think of like instruction manuals or things like that that give you procedural knowledge, or, you know, like a cookbook or something like that. I'm not saying that a cookbook is designed to change your mind, but like it's related to this point because a cookbook is not actually a series of concepts that is intended to remain in this conceptual realm. It's intended to provoke and guide action in the world. And that action is then used to calibrate like further action, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So like, I kind of think that's what philosophy is doing. Now, it's a very different issue to some degree what fiction is doing, because I do think fiction is doing it to some extent. I don't know. Do you want to come in there?
I want to go back to Schopenhauer, but I guess I didn't want to give the wrong impression when we talk about texts. So you've clarified, you mean philosophical texts only, because I think a lot of our experience and also our past discussion around what might happen to the internet and all the texts on the internet as AI starts to take over more and more, and we are less and less able to differentiate people's own writing from machine writing, that there is this less and less ability to perturb other people's reality. And that's a real problem in terms of creativity and that. So I want to make sure that we're clear that what you're talking about in terms of text that wants to change your mind is that philosophical text.
Yes.
And yeah. And that's important.
I think it's a good, it's an important point. I do think that, you know, to some degree, you're right that there are many texts that aren't seeking to change your mind, but many articles, whether it's a blog post or a newspaper piece or whatever, they're designed to kind of like inform you about something you didn't know about, or to, you know, affect your opinion on something, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is a limited sense in which they are trying to change your mind. But it's totally true that not every text is trying to do that, right?
Yes. And again, I think I'm too biased by the previous conversation we had about AI and ChatGPT and the takeover of the internet slowly but surely with these models, because if you are using the corpus already out there of a bunch of structures that say 5 new ways to change your mind about your body image, 10 new ways to write a great article, you get this homogenization. And so there's an illusion on the top that the purpose of writing is to give these new insights and to change your behavior, when in fact it's not actually doing that. It just has this sort of robotic play acting as if it should do that. And I think what good philosophy does when it's doing its job is to help you take on the mantle of these different ways of thinking in the real world and see whether through your action, whether you start becoming aligned to the philosophy that has helped inspire you to take that different kind of action, right? And so this is where I think we can learn a lot from Schopenhauer, and the little that you've taught me about his work is just so different from a lot of the philosophy that I used to be exposed to. So I wonder if you want to dig into
maybe
that a little bit more.
Before going into exactly what he thinks, I'll just bring in another point that's kind of related to what he's saying. Mm-hmm. This is just the fact that maybe with philosophy, it may be that the writing of it and the reading of it, the whole point of it is to change perspective on the world. The problem with involving a language model in that is that it can never have any perspective on the world. It can only ever be exposed to things that are made explicit in a text. So if the idea is, you know, I write a book of philosophy responding to Schopenhauer or something like that. What's happened there is that he's been through life experience, translated that into text. Then I've read his text, translated that back into life experience, and then translated that experience back into text again. Mm-hmm. And if that's what's going on in a philosophical debate, then no language model will ever be able to do that. You see what I mean?
Yeah, of course I see what you mean. Absolutely. And even just to push that, what is happening in that filtration of action, right? Yes, on the surface, a superficial level, a language model can't do that because it's not acting in the world. It doesn't have social emotional relationships. It doesn't have all these things. It's not embodied. It doesn't have a physiological, you know, underpinning to balance, etc. But what else do you think is in that action that goes between text to text?
Trial and error, really.
Great.
And so basically, okay, you adopt part or the entirety of someone else's worldview, you integrate it into yours in ways conscious and unconscious, and that affects your perception affects your action, and you learn from the action, and this informs both your future behavior and your future thinking. And so it's in other words, great. The point of reading philosophy is to change your life. And if it doesn't, if it remains conceptual, that's not a kind of philosophy that I'm really interested in anyway. I'm not saying that there isn't any philosophy that exists like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But
really, I feel like saying once more for the back seats, like it's supposed to change your life. And yes, there is something also about, you know, you once told me that unless you're suffering, of course you don't care about meditation or it doesn't quote unquote work. You don't need it. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I wonder whether people are going to philosophy right now and trying to get oriented in philosophy, or at least some of the people we know, because we need it a whole lot more right now. There is, whether we call it the meta crisis or whether we call it something else, there is something that we feel is transformational at a global and societal and kind of global consciousness level that feels like we need philosophy again, right?
Yes, people either feel an intrinsic need to change their own lives, or they feel some kind of external pressure that they're going to have to change one way or another. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of period, I would expect for like a religious awakening, which has been happening for some years now, I think. And,
yes,
you know, spiritual practices to come back in vogue, as well as philosophy, as well as a kind of, you know, challenging of authority, as well as a kind of woo response to that challenge. And, you know, mm-hmm, so like a kind of back and forth on that level. But one of the other things that struck me is just that if this is the case, that what we get out of philosophy starts in life and ends up back in life, there's a big problem if you can just generate stuff, because there's a high bar to cross. Of course, there's an extremely high bar and slightly random one to get philosophy read after 1,000 years or 2,000 years or whatever it is. Like, there's mm-hmm just so many elements that can go wrong, as yeah we know, because many of the people that I would absolutely love to know what they think, there's just no writing at all. We have just mm-hmm complete hearsay from Pyrrho of Elis, for example. I mean, he in particular didn't write anything, but it would be nice to have his disciples' writings and things like that, but we just don't have it, right?
Right.
So, but there's this other issue, which is even if we don't think like every book that's published is the greatest thing ever, but like the bar to publishing any book is very high. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time. You have to pass a lot of gatekeeping, or, you know, even with self-publishing, I mean, like, it's not like it's a instantaneous task. It's not an easy one, right? And so because there's a high cost to producing texts of this length with the required integration and synthesis work that needs to be done, just any book that's pretty much worth reading, it would be hard to get it done in under a year. And it's yeah much more likely for it to take 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, even 10 years
absolutely
for it to come together, right? Now, that's a cost that has to be borne by a human. And for a human to bear that cost, there has to be some kind of belief that what they're doing is worthwhile and worth the opportunity costs that go into writing a book. In other words, even if we think not all books are that great, like a huge amount of effort has gone into them.
Yes. But so your point to saying that is that only a very few of the ideas that might be being tried out in the world and so on end up bearing this very particular type of fruit that is a codified artifact that we can see and access over millennia. Is that your main point? And that there's lots of...
No.
Oh, go ahead.
That is definitely one of the points. And I think we should come back to this because the ability to see what's not there is incredibly important.
And exactly.
So what you're saying is absolutely right, which is that very few of these bear fruit. But what I'm actually pointing to is the fact that language models are incredibly fast compared to humans, right? And maybe what we get out of a book is that it's vetted not just by gatekeepers, but by the fact that someone spent years of their life on this thing. If someone spent years of their life on it, it does have a deep involvement in their experience, right? Mm-hmm, people don't go in and write books that they don't fundamentally believe in or something. I'm not saying that every book is created equal on that front. You could obviously write a book to become famous, or you could write a book for all kinds of reasons. The point is less that, well, everyone who writes a book is a true believer in what they're doing, and you know, they really deeply think that this is the best thing for the world. Like, I think that would be too strong a claim. But at the same time, what we are getting is like, there's just a very high cost that has been borne by someone in order for this artifact to exist in the world, even in the case of the worst imaginable book.
Absolutely. And there's two other parts. First of all, because it takes time, it necessarily takes some of the guts and blood that the person has lived through, right? And even if it's not explicit trial and erroring of the ideas through action in the world, there is a living in the world that has to some degree become the backdrop of that writing and therefore have some impact on that writing, right? So I think that's really important. Just the time-based element of writing, as you're pointing out, is so important because that's how human thought and action is embedded in that kind of time and space, so which language models don't have. I think that's a very underappreciated point there, that time represents not just like a inefficiency, but something that's integral to how human thought is relevant to our lives, right? So I think that's really, really important. And then the other part is that as much as we have this lone writer stereotype who sits in their office or whatever and writes day and night and is tortured and so on, it's a hugely social process, way beyond just the editor, right? You're going out to the pub and talking to people afterwards. You can't write and you go and sob to your best friend about what's not working, etc. And so these are socially embedded processes, even though they seem like individual. Whereas again, these language models not only are really, really fast, but there's nothing social about them in terms of shifting around ideas.
Absolutely. I think that's a critical point and one that I hadn't really thought about. The other, I mean, you're kind of getting to the heart of this, but maybe I'll just make it explicit, which is that if a language model can generate a book in whatever it is, even if it, you know, it takes a few minutes or something, I guess, I mean, it, you know, it's on the order of like an hour or something like that. Mm-hmm. Then now there's this new artifact that is in some sense in competition with the existing artifacts, right? And of course, you can see that this could just swamp the existing artifacts. But there's more to it than that, right? Because there's a kind of opportunity cost to reading anything, right? Because you could always be reading something else. Mm-hmm. And so there's something in there that I feel like is important because I suppose it's just that if someone has really gone to the lengths that's required to write this book and for you to read it, if it's an ancient book, then not only has it gone through that, but it's gone through the hands of scribes many, many dozens of times. In other words, it is not simply mechanical reproduction as we now, it's hard for us to see the selection pressures through which these texts have gone, right? And this is more than just a Lindy point that if it's old, maybe it's better or something like that. It's actually that it requires not just the commitment of a single individual, but in some sense, the commitment of an entire culture and its lineage for a text to have survived for a period of, let's say, 1,000 years. And some of these texts are older than that, right?
Yes. And here's the flip that I, that is right at the tip of my head, and maybe you'll help me think through it, is that I think one of the most obvious and the most ubiquitous use currently and in the near future, year to 2 years, of ChatGPT will be to summarize.
Yes.
So to, you know, it's not enough anymore for Google to give us the appropriate text that we should read if we're interested in a particular topic, Pyrrhonist thought or whatever it is. It's that we want now ChatGPT to read the 100 pages and give us a one paragraph summary of that. Now, what happens when we start assuming that that summary that supposedly takes these rich, you know, time and space and social embedded experience and information gets summarized in a tiny piece of text? And we have, as the humans imbibing this kind of stuff, the illusion that we understand the insight that's been, you know, given to us through that. I think there's something really weird on that iteration.
Yeah, there's something super important there. And we did talk a little bit about this. I spoke to Maggie about this, and I spoke to her on the podcast about it. You know, the fact that I can read a sentence or two of someone's writing and know who wrote it. You know, people have pointed out that there are these signatures even in operators of Morse code. Do you know about that?
No. Tell me.
So basically, yeah, if you're someone who sends these signals, actually, they're just in the spacing of these binary signals, or they're not quite binary, right? There's, you've got, I guess, kind of gaps and then long and short, whatever it is.
Right.
But it's supposed to be this kind of systematic, like, code, right? But in fact, when people use this way of transmitting, they come to be able to recognize each other, even through this extremely limited bandwidth of information, right? Which is just noise or silence, I suppose. And this is true even when we've stripped down, you know, I've got this screensaver that displays random books. And even at that stripped down level, it takes like about a line or even less, sometimes three words to recognize Nietzsche. Now, Nietzsche has a strong voice.
Yes.
But even, you know, people with potentially less strong voices, something comes through that's more than just in the text.
Oh, for sure. For sure. If you've ever been in these group chats, and some of them are like huge, right? You've got 10 people, 12 people, 20 people. You don't have to look up who's talking. You can basically hear each voice really easily, at least I can, through just their, you know, three or four lines, or the fact that they use an emoji rather than a text or something like that. We're really good at that kind of symbol identification and identity linking, I think.
Yes. And so there's that kind of element. And so that, of course, relates to the summarizing, because the voice will be lost. At the same time, I want to kind of argue, not quite against it, but, you know, Brian McGee wrote this article about clarity in philosophy and the fact that certain people, and, you know, as a Schopenhauer fan, I'm just going to say that Hegel is kind of known for how difficult he is to read and how obscure. Now, though Schopenhauer thought there was no content whatsoever to Hegel's thought, most people, I think, disagree with the strength of that take, basically,
right,
and find something quite worthwhile in Hegel. But at the same time, there's this imitation of him that produces a kind of obscurantism. So what McGee is saying is there is a difference between being a good writer and being a good philosopher. So in other words, you can be a bad writer and a good philosopher. And he thinks that this is not the case for essayist or poet or novelist. You can't be a good novelist and a bad writer. You can't be a good poet but a bad writer. It doesn't make sense.
And we'll link to that article because it's a great article, actually. It's a quick read and it's a really interesting article to think through. What are we doing when we're writing, quote unquote, well, and taking the time to write well and distinctly and with our own individual input and so on? Go on. Sorry.
No, it's okay. The other side of this, of course, is poetry, which is notorious for the fact, it's not notorious, but just like it's been pointed out many times that you can't really change any word in a poem without ruining its effect. Or yes. This is almost always the case, right? Especially with good, the better the poetry is, mm-hmm. the harder it is to change anything about it, right? And so there's a sense in which that is the kind of opposite pole of this, where you deeply cannot touch it. So the fact that philosophy is not that, philosophy is not poetry, although a few mm-hmm. philosophers did end up writing poetry. In other words, philosophy is a kind of living thing in which I can read someone's thought and tell you what it's about, tell you something about it, you know, kind of like, in other words, it allows for summarizing and it allows for rephrasing and all these kind of things, which arguably a novel even does not. In other words, yes, you can summarize the plot of a novel, but that's not really the novel, is it? And, you know, what do you think of that?
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. And I really like that you brought poetry in to contrast, because there is an entire world that is experienced or transmitted in a poem that not only can you not change a word, but there is this sense of essence in a poem that is far beyond the words that are there. It's the structure, it's the rhyme, it's the embodied kind of rhythm of the feeling. And so there's something so important about the first experiments with ChatGPT, where people kept putting in, write a poem about peanut butter sandwiches in Shakespeare style. And what came out, on the one hand, was eerily like, how does it do that? And on the other hand, everyone knew this is not a real poem. This is So what is it that we are capturing? And I think what we're capturing is this sense of how different what a philosophical text, which means to call to us or invites us to understand an entire sort of worldview in a clear enough. And, you know, as much as it drives me crazy when philosophers get into naming and defining and redefining and so on, there's something really important in that task, because it's about aligning one another's worldviews in this extremely careful way, that we care about one another's alignment. We want to get to the same space so that we can move forward and say, now is your experience the same as mine? And when you do this thing, let's come back and say, how did this affect your suffering versus my suffering and so on, right? So I think that's so very important. And I think what poetry does is it has some way of just piercing us through all that conceptualization in some kind of way that's really important.
Yeah, it does reawaken us to experience. This is the defamiliarization thing, which I think both philosophy and poetry do in some regard. And I've thought previously that, you know, within philosophy, one of the reasons to invent new terms, and a lot of philosophers do this, is so that you don't use a familiar term in a way that they don't mean, right? So
yes,
you don't get this impression of understanding what they're saying, while in fact you've kind of got an assumption about a definition of a word. You know, if you coin a term, then someone can't misunderstand it in a certain yeah. sense, because they can misunderstand it by not understanding it at all. But a coined term, at least in the beginning, right? Mm. And I think Nietzsche talks about words as coins that kind of like wear out, because they're all these like bright, shiny metaphors at the start. And then over time, we lose the sense of what they once meant, right? And so he often goes into etymology. But
Before we leave this topic, can you just give us a definition of defamiliarization? This Shlavsky, I think it is, right?
Yeah, Victor because Shlavsky.
I think it's really important. And I think maybe everyone knows what we're talking about when we say defamiliarization, but I think it's important to actually define and give maybe even examples of that.
Yes. So I think I've recorded a little bit on Shklovsky, but if I haven't, I'll link to whatever I've done about him. But basically,
that would be great.
He's a Russian formalist critic from the early part of the 20th century. And he wrote an essay during the First World War. I think he was actually on the front when he wrote this in 1917. And it's called Art as Method or Art as Technique. And he's looking at what he thinks is the kind of most fundamental sort of reason for art. It's a bad way to put it, but he's looking at what art is trying to do or striving to do. And he looks mainly at examples from Tolstoy, where he thinks that Tolstoy is finding mechanisms of like making familiar things unfamiliar or defamiliarizing. The Russian word is ostranenie. And the idea is that Tolstoy is often finding a way to describe things anew. So, for example, in Haji Murat, he has, you know, this guy up in the Caucasus, he's a foreign figure, right? A kind of like alien landed on Earth kind of trope, which mm-hmm. of course lots of fiction uses these kind mm-hmm. of things. Like you have a stranger in a strange land and then they get to experience all these things that would be familiar, but you get an excuse to describe them as if they're unfamiliar. Right. And so in Haji Murat, you've got, you know, a kind of like ball described by someone who's never seen one. Or, you know, in War and Peace, you get this opera scene where Natasha goes to the opera for the first time. And so by being the first time, she both sees the kind of transformative magic and yet the somehow disturbing, surreal artificiality of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and she kind of vacillates between these two sort of sides of being able to suspend her disbelief and being drawn in and at the same time being drawn out and seeing it kind of like from the outside, which is, but of course he couldn't describe, there needs to be an excuse to describe this in this mm-hmm. way, right? And so what Shklovsky is saying is that this is a general point of art. I won't say that it's like the only purpose of art, but you could imagine that it is a quite central one, which is to kind of take familiar experiences and make us see them in a different way. So again, like we were saying about philosophy, the point is to change your life on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And so that idea, I mean, it comes up elsewhere, just making the familiar unfamiliar and the kind of coincidence of these. I mean, it makes me think of Freud, this unheimlich thing where heimlich means this sort of same thing as its opposite. There are these kind of words where, genus words, where a word means itself and its opposite. And one of these right. is homely, right? And so it's like the homely being the most familiar place and the most comfortable comes to mean its opposite, which is like unhomely. And there is there's something in that, which is like, you know, horror films are often set in homes, right? It's like,
right.
You know, there's something particular about making the familiar unfamiliar in a horror film, let's say, that, yeah, I don't know. That was maybe a bit of a tangent. But the, yeah, Schopenhauer thing is just this idea in The World as Will and Representation that what's going on in experience, what we have in experience is always intuitively understood immediately and in space. So everything is given to us. You know, you open your eyes, there's the room in front of you. And the room presents itself holistically, intuitively understood, everything in it. It's not that everything in it is necessarily familiar, but there's not really like a temporal aspect to it. And arguably there's only kind of like a semblance of a temporal aspect to space in the most constrained environments, like inside mm-hmm. a room, let's say. Because in nature, you don't really get this. It's not,
right.
You know, it's even like a fairly artificial wood, like I live near, you know, is not the same 2 days in a row, much less,
yes.
you know, over the course of a year or something.
Yes. And
so Schopenhauer is basically just pointing out the fact that everything we experience is always unique, right? You know, even if it feels very similar, you're going to the same dead end 9-to-5 job every single day, making the same commute, you know, eating the same meal. In fact, every day is unique. Like, even if it doesn't feel mm-hmm. that way, experience itself never repeats, right?
Yes.
And yet, there's this other thing we do, which is language. And language is kind of this logical, ordered, structured thing. Ironically, it kind of relates to this defamiliarization thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
it familiarizes things, right?
Yes.
Nietzsche actually says this. He says, words make the uncommon common.
Yes.
So if what we're saying is that poetry reawakens us to words and to life, you could say that prose makes things prosaic, which is that to say that essentially it familiarizes things because it puts things into categories that, I mean, I'm going to argue that all categories are essentially emergent constructions so that they can't be found, right? So right. This is a kind of partially Buddhist point. It relates to the Western medieval debate. It's called the problem of universals. But regardless of like what you think philosophically about that, you can probably agree that if I say book, you know, you might imagine something. I'm going to imagine something different. I'm in a room filled with books. And in a way, this category, like any one of these can substitute into this category, even though mm-hmm. each of them is mm-hmm. a unique object. Mm-hmm. And unique in the sense that maybe it's a, you know, very common book. I've got the Wilhelm I Ching here. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a book that I'm sure was published in very large numbers. And so there's probably millions of these things out there. I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands. And yet this one is unique. Like even
I've got
though
my green bound one up there.
You've got a green one.
That's
yeah.
the one right there. Yeah.
This is a black one. But you see what I mean? Like yes. even if someone had the same black one, this one has a sticker on it. The back is kind of beat up, etc. We can agree that it's not the same object, at least.
Right.
Now, in this built environment that we have, things are kind of interchangeable, right? As in, you know, you get a new phone, it does roughly the same thing as another phone. But for most of human history, things weren't really substitutable, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, people aren't substitutable, obviously. And most things in nature aren't really either, you know? Like, you could argue that maybe domesticated yes. plants are more substitutable, but...
And so is yeah, there sorry. Some point there that Schopenhauer is saying that in what we do, everything is unique, and in particular, we could see that more readily if we walk through nature and see that the same, you know, tree has lost a limb today or whatever it is, not limb, branch, etc. But that when we use language, language automatically does this categorization, which lumps a bunch of uniqueness into a familiar bucket. And so with language comes a distancing of experience and the awareness of the uniqueness. Is that where he's going with this?
I think Nietzsche goes further in that direction than Schopenhauer does. Schopenhauer's mm-hmm. point, and I was kind of editorializing and adding in Nietzsche and stuff like that. So to get back on topic.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Schopenhauer is saying something like, look, you can live your whole life and get very good at all kinds of concrete actions. He gives the example of a pool player that I'm sure I've mentioned to you before. Mm-hmm. As a pool player, you're using perception and action. And I think perception and action are deeply linked. And mm-hmm. so... you have these goals and you set them up, but in a way, I'm not trying to say that like every position is going to be entirely unique, but in a way it is, right? Because you're coming to it with a certain set of skills. You're in this certain configuration. It's very much in the present. There's not really yes. a past and future to it. Of course, the balls move in time over time, but in general, like the experience and getting good at it doesn't actually require any conceptual knowledge. So that's mm-hmm. one of the important things. It's mm-hmm. it takes time to train the skill, yes, but the skill is trained in space and always in the present, right? But if that same pool player is to write a book that's to teach someone how to play pool, he's got to do this long period, like we were saying about how long it takes to write a book. It's just inherently temporal. It takes
yes.
a very long time to do it. And it's translating this kind of three-dimensional thing that you have in space that's always immediate into this ordered one-dimensional thing, which is a series of words. And it's yeah. more extreme in the written form, which of course is quite new. We have to always remind ourselves that writing is only a few thousand years old, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas mm-hmm. speech is much, much older. Now, even if he's to speak and tell someone and have them be trained in front of him, it is this thing that unfolds over time. And language is just inherently temporal. I mean, some languages yes. are more ordered than others. Like English, the word order matters a lot. And in German, it does. Not every language is like that. But at the same time, every language does unfold over time. There's not, mm-hmm. you know, you don't just pick up a book and know it, right? And that you don't, in the same way that you don't have a conversation in a fraction of a second and it's done, right?
Yes.
It's a time-bound thing. And in a certain sense, especially in the written form, it's one-dimensional. So this is the mm-hmm. point that Schopenhauer is making, which is that the act of writing and reading a book is an act of translation from space into time, from three mm-hmm. dimensions into one dimension, from something like experience into something like logic,
right,
or like yeah. mathematics. And in a certain sense, these things are always antithetical. Mm-hmm. Now, when you read a book, it's the opposite process if you're going to put this book into action, like we were saying, you know, that even to read a recipe book, right? You know, there's all kinds of assumptions in there. A cookbook, I mean, you know, this kind of ties us back to GPT-3.
And exactly.
What, you know, what we know, because if it says you can write dice and onion and either the reader knows how to do that or doesn't know how to do that, right? But whether they know or not, that act is fundamentally non-linguistic. And it mm-hmm. will always remain that way, no matter how mm-hmm. much you describe it, right? So yes. you might have a very basic cookbook that says, what dicing means is to cut things into this size, and the way you do that with an onion is you start on this end and do this, or mm-hmm. you know, whatever yeah. the case may be. But I think the point in Schopenhauer is really important, which is that there's a sense in which two things are going on. One is perception, which is given in intuition and always immediate. Mm-hmm. Versus something like rationality. I'm hesitant to use the word reason. Let's just keep it at rationality, which unfolds over time. It's somehow sequential as opposed to parallel. And it is linguistic somehow as well, or it's more subject to language. It's easier to put yes. into words, right? And so, and this fundamental, you can see how this relates to some of our previous discussions, because of course, the experimental sciences versus the historical sciences, there's this kind of difference between space and time somehow.
Yeah.
It's like a little hard to exactly say what it is, but I'm sure there's, well, I'm sure there is a relationship.
I think there is. And I think that what we're struggling with understanding, I think, is absolutely essential to where we started, which was, you know, what is this whole AI thing doing to our will do and is doing in terms of our sense of understanding and how much we're communicating, to what degree is it human-like, what does it lose, why is it that it can't be wise in a way that we think of wisdom from philosophers and so on. And I think this idea of necessarily taking a three-dimensional space and time experience and collapsing it into a one-dimensional, logical, constrained artifact of summary to some degree, you know, it reminds me very much of your neither nor approach, right? It's not that one is necessarily the only way, like experience is the only way to think about how we should go about our life in terms of information flow and so on, or that the conceptual is only that way. It's that these two come together, much like left brain, right brain, and can complement one another. And it's only by understanding what we lose in either one of them or the other that we get a full conception of what we might be trying to do with a more useful, functional philosophy as we move forward in trying to live our lives right now.
Yes. And, you know, because I'm thinking, yeah, how does this relate to experiments versus historical sciences? Because we've said before that historical sciences are story-based, and stories, of course, take place in language. And so it seems like that's a kind of contradiction, although this thing came up in A.C. Graham that I was looking at, The Disputers of the Tao, about Chinese philosophy, and he talks about this. It's a great quote. I can find it in a little bit. It's just about the idea that as soon as rationalism comes about in China, there's this immediate reaction in Zhuangzi. And basically, he's saying that they understand that logic has its a kind of place, but that it should only ever be about means and not ends. And then when he talks about what can be used for ends, he gives parable, poetry, experience, And I think he gives one other thing. I'm not remembering the fourth thing. But just this idea that story may actually be this kind of right hemisphere thing. And that's why the historical sciences are using it, because it actually, it's kind of more flexible and it's more lifelike than the equations that we get out of the end of a successful series of physics experiments, right?
Because yes.
Which in the end, in its ultimate form, is somehow mathematical, right? It's pushing towards these laws. But you could say that early experimentation, it's still more law-like, even if it's not an equation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it tends to simplify. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and it tends to, well, that goes into an entirely different area that we might want to get into in you know, future episodes, around how mathematics might be a language to maybe describe or summarize, but that it isn't necessarily the nature of our world per se. So we use, just like we use language to describe, summarize, communicate about our world, it's not that there's something language-like integral to that world. But that's, I think, way getting off of where we are right now.
No, it's okay. And I do think, yeah, I want to go back into this Schopenhauer thing. I think it's like sections 12 and 13 of the first volume of World as Will and Representation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's something important in there. Yeah, just to come back to ChatGPT, because implicitly ChatGPT assumes that the only things that are important are what's made explicit on one level or another. Mm-hmm. It ignores everything that's implicit. And what we were saying earlier is that the conversation might start at the point where the implicit ends.
Yes.
But it kind of says nothing about what that implicit contains. And it also somehow relates to poetry. The only thing, I'll say this and then you can tell me if it's related or not.
Mm-hmm.
In the best songwriting, often the best lines depend on an unfulfilled expectation of what's to come next. And that can never be explicit.
Yes.
Because it consists in surprise. And surprise can only come from this unfulfilled expectation. Now, maybe one argument would be that, you know, GPT can gobble up this entire corpus and then it will have these expectations and therefore it will know what to predict and it can produce surprise by violating, you know, its expectations, but I don't know.
Yeah, but I think, okay, so it's remarkable that you got me to the same place that was my question three. So in terms of Schopenhauer, you have also talked to me about Schopenhauer's discussion around intuition and the importance of intuition versus rationality.
Yes.
And I think what you're pointing to in terms of this surprise element and this, you know, these aha experiences and insight that people talk about in science as well, but also in religious experiences, in really good conversations when we have something that emerges and goes like, ah, how did you get to the same place I did?
Mm.
And how did we both get to here? Because we didn't actually, neither one of us expected it. That kind of experience that's kind of in the moment and temporal and emergent requires intuition. And it's not in a superficial way that we can say that language models don't have that. It's because the process of imagination requires history and a personal history and a sense of experiential history, right? That you can't get from just an averaging across a bunch of people. So this is another thing I really wanted to get to, and maybe we'll just have to shelve it for another time, but part of what these language models do are they are an average across people. They are not an average within a person's experience, right?
Yes.
And what we do when we average, we take means and standard deviations and so on, is that we're actually not representing one individual at all. It may not represent any one of us, actually. It just has a sense of this is us as a big schmutz of an average. And so I think that's also really important in terms of intuition, because intuition works properly when it is an individual experience kind of coming to light and then feels like it is relevant to a general population rather than this general thing that we all can say, I can kind of see that, right?
Yeah, and I think this has come up before, just the idea that human writing is default unique and with effort, it can be made to sound generic, mm-hmm. as in science writing or you know, whatever the kind of style yes. guide that you're supposed to. But
yes.
in a certain sense, anything generated from a language model is going to default to generic, and it can potentially be made to sound unique with some kind of effort. Mm-hmm. But they are opposites in a certain sense.
Absolutely. And so I think that that's partially your point, right? Is what is the point of philosophy and the writing of philosophy, if not to generate important insights about living our lives and then to have individual experiential sort of input as data to update or to think about the relevance of this to individuals. So again, how does one develop a philosophy when all it is an averaging of what's come before, right?
Yes. And there are certain places where I think these models will be really useful. You know, if I'm writing code and I just want to fix some problem in the code, there's like a kind of finite number of, maybe there's not a finite number, but there's, you know, there's a number of right answers to this thing. Whereas uh-huh. life is not like that. There's not right answers in life.
Really?
And so like, if you know what I mean? Like this averaging effect of like stack exchange responses is only going to work in like certain domains. And it may work very well in those domains, but in others, it's going to really mess things up, I think, you know?
I agree. And I think one of the things that you're pointing to with all of the work you're doing with philosophy and the neither nor approach is that these models, they're not just technologies that we can go and use and so on. They shape the way we think and the metaphors by which we live our lives. So if we start believing that, you know, it's about efficiency and summarizing and getting to the crux of whatever it is rather than the time-based slow process of experience and trial and error in our own individual lives rather than the average, etc. There's all sorts, I think, of implications of believing the mind is like ChatGPT if we only got it good enough, right? And I think part of what you're doing with the neither nor approach is to go, no, it's not that one, you know, logical approach, or purely go take a bunch of acid and sit around and look at the sky kind of thing. There's something important about batting back and forth.
Yeah. And it is a kind of pushing in two directions at once that remains important. Yeah. And I am concerned about the kind of obviousnesses that will occur if we are just reading generated text. I'm worried about the opportunity costs, as I said, of not reading older things because we're reading, you know, some generated thing.
Yes.
And at the same time, I don't want to like kind of overamplify the importance of Western philosophy because in my view, it has itself undergone radical homogenization over its lifetime. And, you know, in some sense, GPT is just a logical extension of what it's already been doing for at least 300 years and maybe arguably 2,500 years in terms of purging dissenting voices and essentially going into this rationalist mode and system building mode, which tends rather to undervalue experience than to, yeah, I suppose properly value it. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's really an important point because it, yeah, you do not idealize the Western canon of philosophy in a straightforward way by any means. And I think that the incorporation of Eastern wisdom traditions of not only, you know, philosophical, but also practice orientation is really important in this work. Yeah, so do you feel like you've sort of expressed the most important ideas you wanted to, you know, explore with Schopenhauer in terms of this context right now? Is there anything
I think
else
I've gotten
feels
as far as I can get? I need to return to him and I'm still not even done with that book yet. So I'm going to be working on that for a while, but I think it hopefully at least connects a few dots in terms of, we haven't really mentioned dependent origination, but I do think somehow that Schopenhauer is a link between the detective work involved in dependent origination and why it has to work the way that it does, and this kind of division between history and the experimental sciences. But I think that may be as inarticulate in my brain as it is in my mouth at the moment.
Oh, I think so. First of all, just a la what we were saying before, I think this is really importantly a time stretchy kind of process of linking these things together, and these conversations provide the stepping stones in a river that continually kind of keeps going in terms of both input, like different types of readings that both of us are doing, but also in terms of how these ideas are being taken from other people who are having discussions with you. So for those who are only listening to this one episode for the first time and haven't heard you talk about dependent origination, there's quite a bit of information that you've started to put out about that approach. And we can link that in the show notes. And then there's also discussions that you've had around historical versus experimental sciences. And then now this idea of Schopenhauer's formulation of how language reifies or brings us into this conceptual consensus about what we're talking about, perhaps too soon, or overrides unique experience, I think absolutely loops into the dependent origination practice and also philosophy. And I think we're going to keep looping into these ideas from different points, different entry points. I think it's really important. Just this process of discussion, I think, is absolutely crucial.
Yes. And we've talked about the sort of forward order of dependent origination as a process of not just linear causal thinking, but the reification of concepts. Mm. And things like language models are only going to intensify that, because if what's called for to improve a concept is a return to evidence and experience, that is something that a language model can never do.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And it's not a, I do feel like it is at the edge of something absolutely important about this, because it goes back to the experimental and historical sciences and the assumption in experimental sciences that you are doing a study and you are controlling the context in such a way to isolate causal factors so that you can generalize out into the world, right?
You're trying to make the world, you're trying to make experience interchangeable.
Exactly. Right. And we are saying that that may be fine for a certain class of problems.
Yes.
But certainly not how, well, first and foremost, to live one's life and what philosophy is doing and so on.
Exactly. Shall we leave it there?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm buzzing, but yeah, I think it's great. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. Until next time.
This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/briancam, where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.